A few weeks later, the Gazette received a tantalizing letter, a plea from a group of Indian cab drivers. 50 of them had been brought to the kingdom 7 years before with the promise of office jobs in private companies and a guaranteed monthly wage of 600 reals. They included a copy of the contract with their letter. Upon their arrival, the employer seized their passports and their residence permits and told them that they actually would be limousine drivers, that is, cabbies, and that rather than receiving a wage, they would be required to pay daily rent on their cabs. Some of the men didn't even have a driver's license, but they were all thrown out onto the chaotic streets of Jeddah. The men were crowded into a hovel, stranded, hungry, virtual prisoners. After enduring a series of indignities, including beatings, 15 of the men had gone on strike. There is no clear figure on how many expats, as all foreign workers are called, are in the kingdom. 4 million? 9 million? Nobody knows. But very few people know how many Saudis there are either. Since King Faisal's census in the 60s, the actual population figure has been a state secret, a source close to the Interior Ministry told me. The king saw the figure was low, and he immediately doubled it. According to CIA statistics, the native population is about 19 million, but the actual number of Saudis may be as few as 10 million. Certainly, one has the feeling, in the cities at least, that there are as many expats as Saudis. Expats hold 7 out of 10 jobs in the kingdom and 90% of all private sector positions. For decades, the Saudi government has been attempting to replace foreigners with native workers, but it has run into resistance from employers who don't want to hire their own people. "Saudis aren't qualified," Prince Sultan bin Salman bin Abdul Aziz, the Secretary General for Tourism, told me. Showing up for a job is not a priority for them. Even the culture of working as a team is not there. Increasingly, the unemployed natives tend to view the Bangladeshi houseboys, the Lebanese waiters, and the Egyptian barbers with resentment rather than gratitude. "We hate it," a Saudi friend exclaimed when I asked how he felt when he had to speak English or Urdu just to order coffee. Entry-level service jobs, however, are forms of employment that Saudis refuse to accept. The expat readership of the Gazette would, I thought, see the Indian cabbie story in a sympathetic light. I arranged for 3 of the drivers who had signed the letter to come to the Gazette offices to talk to Faisal Bajaber, a smart Indian reporter who had just graduated from high school. The cab drivers were led by Ninon Filippos, a small, intense man in a dirty shirt who arrived carrying a thick file of documents. He had the bearing of a man who is not easily intimidated. His wife was desperately ill in India, he told us. He had planned to visit her, but when he sought his passport from his employer, company goons had dragged him to a detention center for illegal aliens. The owner of the limousine company beat him in front of several immigration officers. Filippos and some other men had complained to the Indian embassy about their treatment, to no effect. Because they were expats, they had no real legal standing in the country. Their employer had made them sign documents in Arabic that they couldn't read, as well as some blank sheets of paper. One of the drivers told Faisal that the owner of the company had his own jail, where he locked up drivers who defied him. I watched Faisal interviewing the drivers in Urdu, although he had lived nearly his entire life in the kingdom. Faisal was not allowed to attend the public universities, because he didn't have Saudi citizenship. Yet he spoke 5 languages, and his English was nearly flawless. He asked detailed questions and took careful notes. He had the makings of an excellent journalist. Faisal presented the story at a reporters' meeting. Dr. Shukani listened sleepily until he heard that the owner of the limousine company had a private jail. Then he nearly jumped out of his chair. "He's not a prince, is he?" he asked. "No, well, we'll go after him." After several weeks, Faisal produced a draft. The owner of the limousine company had dodged him, saying only that the drivers were lying. Now the drivers and the owner were headed for labor court, where such disputes are nearly always resolved in favor of the Saudi employers. Faisal called me to say that there was a problem with the story. I went into Ramesh's office to find Faisal and Dr. Yusuf, the editor-in-chief, who was reading the draft. The reporters were frightened of him. He was a slight man with shrewd eyes and a nervous giggle, but he had an unguarded temper, and he didn't mind humiliating his employees. Yusuf wasn't really a newsman. He was a former professor of advertising, but I tried to appeal to his sense of community. There really was no reason for the Gazette to exist if it didn't address the kinds of concerns detailed in the cab driver's story. Yusuf waved the draft dismissively and observed that Faisal hadn't talked to the Indian embassy. That seemed a small if valid point. Faisal had a letter registering a complaint by the embassy on behalf of the drivers. Yusuf also noted that the court hearing was the following morning. "We don't want to put pressure on the government," he said. "What's wrong with that?" I asked. Yusuf explained that the cab drivers would pay the price for any quixotic effort on our part to champion their case. Then he handed the story back to Faisal. I protested a bit, but walked out compliantly. Maybe Dr. Yusuf was right. I didn't want the penniless cab drivers to be punished because of my principles. I recalled the story of Abdalkarim Mara'i al-Naqshbandi, a Syrian expat worker who had been sentenced to death for allegedly practicing witchcraft against his employer, a nephew of King Fahd. The evidence against him was absurd. Human rights workers leaped on the case when they discovered that Naqshbandi's employer had wanted him to falsely testify against another employee, and when he refused, made the witchcraft charge. Naqshbandi became a cause célèbre, but he was peremptorily beheaded, a grisly message to outsiders who meddled in Saudi affairs. The next day, the cab drivers went to labor court. Faisal told me that the Arabic document that they had signed when they first arrived in the kingdom released the owner from any financial liability. The owner also produced other documents, apparently made up from the blank sheets of paper the drivers had signed, which said that they owed him several thousand rials each. "What will happen to them now?" I asked. "They're going to prison," he told me. Faisal's story on the drivers never appeared. Hassan Hatrash was walking in circles in front of the Okaz building when I arrived. He looked shaken. "Oh my God," he told me. "I found a dead body."
"Where?"
"Right here, in the garden." He led me around the side of the building, next to the parking lot. "It's not a body, actually, but bones, human bones. A jawbone, anyway, and I think there are other bones around it." Between the side street and the parking lot was a median strip that recently had been planted with sprigs of oleander. There was some debris, a matchbook, some nails, shards of a coffee cup, and a human jawbone jutting out of the soil.
"You see, I dug around it a bit," Hatrash told me. "There are other bones under there."
"Huh." We watched a fly land on the bone and then move on. I suggested we call the police.
"You can call them, but they won't come," he said. "It's better if you find one and get him to call on his radio."
We got in my car and drove around looking for a policeman, which took a surprisingly long time.
The cop then had us follow him to the local substation. It was in the bottom floor of an apartment house, a dim room with gray linoleum tiles and broken-bottom leather chairs with foam spilling out of the arms. Two young detectives sat behind desks, taking reports. On the wall above them, there was a Quranic injunction. "Whoever fears God, a way will be opened for him." One of the detectives, wearing a khaki uniform and sandals, came over to the newspaper office to view the jawbone. He warily agreed that it looked human, but he didn't seem to know what to do with it. He drove off without marking it as a crime scene. The next morning, the jawbone was gone, but we never heard from the officer again. I had expected more of a police state. The nature and scope of the repression were hard to calculate. I did encounter frequent roadblocks, mainly designed to trap illegal residents. American intelligence officials told me to expect that the Saudis would monitor my phone calls and emails, and even break into my apartment and clone my computer. So I was on guard. "See that building?" a lawyer said to me under his breath as we drove down Talia Street. He indicated with his eyes a large two-story structure at the corner of Medina Road. "That's the political jail." There was nothing notable about it, except for the absence of shops or signs on the ground floor. I didn't see any obvious security forces around it. The lawyer said that he had had clients detained there in the past. "Who's in there now?" I asked. "Who knows?" In contrast with Egypt, where nearly everyone knew somebody who had been illegally arrested and often tortured, in Saudi Arabia, few people could say that they knew someone who had been detained for political reasons. Jeddah residents were always looking over their shoulders, but had only vague rumors to report when I pressed them. I did meet a man who had been tortured by the Saudi secret police 10 years before. "They tickled me here," he said, showing me his hands, which were scarred by knife wounds. "They thought he had helped a dissident escape the country." "If I knew how to do that, I would escape myself," he had told them. "You are being watched," a Gazette editor once told me. He spoke to me in a stairwell, where he assumed we wouldn't be overheard. "How do you know?" "A man came this morning from the secret police to see Dr. Yusuf. After this, Dr. Yusuf called me in to ask about you." I asked what Dr. Yusuf wanted to know. "How you were doing? What you were up to?" the editor said. That didn't sound so sinister. Dr. Yusuf repeatedly asked about my welfare and kindly expressed concern for my safety, especially since during my stay, several Westerners were assassinated. No one from the Ministry of Information came to see me. No minders were assigned, and if anyone could follow me in Jeddah traffic, he represented a force beyond reckoning. But suspicion darkened the atmosphere in Saudi Arabia, even among people who worked together every day. I asked Mahmoud Shukri, a 17-year-old reporter, where his friends were going to school. "We don't tell each other things like that," he said, when he asked my advice about college plans. "We had to meet outside the office to avoid being overheard." "If you let people know what you are up to, they might be envious," he explained. Telephone numbers were especially hard to obtain. One of the more experienced Gazette reporters kept an old ledger with handwritten numbers he had compiled over the years. It was perhaps the most valuable document in the entire office, given the reluctance of many Saudis to be listed. By now, I had begun to look at Saudi society as a collection of opposing forces, the liberals against the religious conservatives, the royal family versus democratic reformers, the unemployed against the expats, the old against the young, men against women, The question was whether the anger that results from all this conflict would be directed outward, at the West, or inward, at the Saudi regime. I went to the Ministry of Interior in Riyadh, hoping to gain permission to talk to members of Saudi intelligence who had investigated the September 11th hijackers. The ministry is one of the largest branches of the Saudi government, with 500,000 employees. Its building is a giant inverted pyramid, which looms like a Death Star on the edge of downtown Riyadh. I was told that the architect was a poet, and that the building was a structural catastrophe. It certainly projects an air of menace. Inside the marble atrium, black tubular elevator columns rise through the interior balconies. The summit of this upside-down building is a dome with an 8-pointed star. My appointment was with Dr. Saeed Al-Harthy, who was an advisor to the Interior Minister and the chairman of the board of OCAS, and therefore at the top of the Gazette masthead. All lines of power in the Saudi press converge in this building. I had been promised an interview with Prince Naif, the Interior Minister, and he had prepared a long list of questions about the hijackers. A year after September 11th, the prince had asserted that Zionists were behind the plot. I cannot still believe that 19 youths, including Saudis, carried out the September 11th attacks with the support of bin Laden, he said. It's impossible. Then in February, Saudi police rounded up more than 90 al-Qaeda suspects. Nevertheless, Prince Naif maintained that there was no terrorist threat in Saudi Arabia. It seemed like a bizarre blindness on the part of the man charged with protecting the kingdom, and I was eager to hear his explanation. Dr. Harthy had other ideas, however. He wanted to talk only about the Gazette. He asked me what I thought could help sales. The circulation has shrunk to nearly nothing, he said. He had a copy of the paper on his desk and glanced at it without actually reading it. I think the name is the problem, he continued. Saudi Gazette sounds like a government publication. I told him that it would sell more copies if it were a better paper, if it covered local news and took more courageous editorial stands. I don't think that Prince Naif would really be that helpful to you, Dr. Harthy said. It took a moment for me to realize that he had abruptly canceled my appointment. A few hours after I visited the ministry, a house blew up in central Riyadh. Later that night, I was having a shisha, flavored tobacco in a water pipe, with one of Naif's assistants and asked about it. Some guy, he had a lot of explosives in his house, and it blew up, he said unconcernedly. It seemed far more ominous to me. I wanted to see how the law worked in the kingdom, so in April, I asked Hassan Baswed to do a story on a new legal code, put into effect in May 2002, which guarantees defendants the right to consult with an attorney. It also contains a prohibition against torture. The kingdom had been struggling to conform to international legal standards in order to succeed in its bid to join the World Trade Organization. There are only about 700 judges in the entire country, all of whom are trained exclusively in Sharia, or Islamic law. Baswed landed an interview with Khalid Abu Rashid, a prominent attorney, and I went along. I asked if the new code was creating a class of Western-style criminal defense attorneys. Here, our cases are very simple, not complicated like in America, Rashid told us. We have been mainly concerned with financial crimes. Other types of crimes, like murder, are very rare here, and they are mainly revenge killings among tribes. Those score settlings seldom get to court, he explained. Crimes such as robbery, he said, always happen with foreigners, and when they're captured, they immediately confess, not just about the new crime, but about all the rest. They do not ask for lawyers. On the table in Rashid's office were homemade ma'amoul, date-filled pastries, and fresh dates from his native province. He wore a silver watch with diamonds that caught the light. The judicial system is fixed because it depends on Sharia, he said. For example, the idea that a killer should be killed in return, this will not change. What can change are the procedures that must be followed before you can kill someone. When we left, I made a joke about how eager people in Saudi Arabia were to confess. The justice system often demanded the incontestable proof that only confessions can provide. A Western-style prosecutorial quid pro quo didn't seem to be operating here. People frequently confessed to crimes that guaranteed them the death penalty. Torture, I supposed, was the unmentioned motivator. In February, for instance, after Saudi security forces arrested the 8 purported members of Al-Qaeda in connection with the Riyadh shooting, all the suspects confessed to murder. The voluntary surrender of culprits to police and their confessions reaffirm their desire to return to the right path and correct their mistakes, a member of the Interior Ministry told Asharq al-Awsat. Similarly, Saudi authorities charged 7 British citizens with a series of bombings in Riyadh in 2000 and 2001 that were alleged to have been part of a mob war among bootleggers. 6 of them confessed on Saudi television. The Guardian of London published a story arguing that all the men were tortured into making the statements, or else the confessions were fabricated. The bombings, the paper insinuated, were actually targeted assassinations by Islamists against Westerners who consumed alcohol. Soon afterward, more bombs went off, yet all the accused men remained in jail. After considerable pressure by the British government, the men were released. One of those arrested, Ron Jones, later said that he had been beaten on the soles of his feet. Another detainee said, "They threatened to plant drugs in my house to get my wife and child beheaded." There is a stark difference between the way the Saudi government treats its own citizens and the way it treats foreign workers. There is a huge population that is not thought of as human at all, Khalid Abu El Fadl, the UCLA law professor, told me. If you exclude Iraq, then Saudi Arabia would be one of the worst offenders in the Arab world. In Saudi Arabia, there is a well-established practice of disappearances, people who have been missing for 10 or 15 years. In Saudi Arabia, the death penalty is usually carried out in public. The senior public executioner was a man named Ahmad Rezkala, who had been chopping off the heads of murderers, rapists, and drug smugglers in the public square for 23 years. He killed more than 300 people in that time, 70 of them women, who were dispatched with 2 shots to the head. "Most of the women I executed were strong and calm," he told Al-Majalla, an Arabic-language magazine published in London. "Women in general have nerves of steel." His technique with the men is to poke the condemned person in the back with the tip of his sword, which causes the head to jerk upward. Then, off it comes. The practice of public execution gives the Saudi legal system a medieval reputation in the West. The Saudi method appears to succeed as deterrence. Crime is very low. In Texas, where I live, executions are common, but clemency is as rare as a snowstorm, and the governor holds himself aloof from the process of pardons and paroles. In Mecca province, the governor himself chairs a committee of reconciliation that asks the families of victims to spare the life of the convicted man or woman. Before killing the condemned person, the executioner once again publicly begs the family of the victim to show mercy. "I go and ask the family of the victim to give the criminal another chance, the executioner told Al-Majalla. It has worked many times, and the family has forgiven the criminal at the last minute. There is clapping and cheering. The scenes of happiness are indescribable. Sometimes, wronged family members insist on carrying out the execution themselves, which is permitted in Saudi Arabia. They usually make a mess of it. When American soldiers had crossed into Iraq in March 2003, many Saudis were furious. The U.S. is dying to slaughter the Iraqi people, Prince Amr Mohammed Al-Faisal, an architect in Jeddah, said to me on the eve of the invasion. They're thirsty for it. They can't wait. But many who denounced the invasion in front of their friends privately confessed to me that at least a part of them welcomed it. This entire region is in a fossilized state, Prince Amr conceded. What is happening in Iraq is going to shake up the whole business. My guess is it will lead to greater nationalism. There will be more robust participation in decision-making, although not necessarily a democracy like in the West. We need a push, one reporter told me. Maybe this is it. The night before the war began, I went to dinner with Isan Bou Ulega, an economist and member of the Shura Council, the king's consultative body. Outside the Chinese restaurant, a sandstorm darkened the streets and blurred the lights of the passing traffic. Isan and I had spoken several times before, and I had begun to regard him as a friend. A pale man, with blue eyes and a blonde goatee, he was part of the minority Shia community, but he said he didn't feel persecuted. On the contrary, he was grateful for the many advances that have lifted the country from the poverty of his childhood. When I was a kid, I lived in a small mud house in Hofuf, a village in the eastern province, he told me. It wasn't only my family. Everyone lived in a very humble house. Even King Abdulaziz. We didn't have streets to speak of, just narrow, unpaved roads. Directly beneath the sand of Hofuf, however, was the largest oil field in the world. The kingdom then had a new problem. What to do with the money? In 1970, it inaugurated its first five-year development plan. At the time, we had very little infrastructure, said Isan. We built schools, highways, hospitals. We sent people abroad to study, and we invited people from abroad to work. I can't claim that the oil revenues were used in the most efficient way, but in comparison to other developing countries, we've done very well. The sandstorm had grown more intense while we were in the restaurant. When we came out, the wind was sharp and grating, and the air above the streetlights was an ominous shade of orange. The same storm was creating havoc a few hundred miles away among the American and British forces in Kuwait, preparing to cross the border into Iraq. This is God standing in the way of your guys, Isan teased. But he was also angry and full of dread. Yesterday there was an official announcement from the royal court about prayer. The ruler has asked the people to go outside the city into the emptiness to pray. It was called istisqa, which is ordinarily a rain-seeking prayer. Muslims feel when there has been no rain for a long time, God is angry at them, Isan continued, so they go into the desert and beseech him to forgive them. This year, it is because of Iraq. The people try to be as humble as possible. Certain people wear their clothes inside out just to show their humility. It's very close to panicking, this prayer. The next day, the weather cleared, and American bombers began their assault on Baghdad. War is supposed to be great for newspapers. Khaled Al-Maina, the editor of Arab News, boasted that newsstand sales were already up 27% on the first morning of the war. He had one reporter embedded with the U.S. Marines and two in Kuwait, trying to sneak across the border into Iraq. At the Gazette, no one spoke of sales, since there were scarcely any, and none of our reporters were anywhere near combat. When I came into the office, the Indian editors were crowded around the television set, but they were watching the World Cup cricket matches. It wasn't their war. I was a little anxious about going outside. People had been warning me constantly of the explosion of anger that would definitely accompany the invasion if it really happened. For weeks, Saudis had been telling themselves that the war talk was just a very showy bluff, and that all the chest-pounding proclamations from the Pentagon about shock and awe were only meant to terrify Saddam into surrendering power. There was some discussion about offering him sanctuary in the kingdom, but Prince Naif squelched that. Saudi Arabia already had plenty of political refugees, he said. Idi Amin, the former man-eating dictator of Uganda, was one of Jeddah's most infamous citizens. I had hoped they were right. There were peace marches all over the globe, even in other Arab countries, but not in Saudi Arabia. My own wife and children were marching in Austin, Boston, and Florence, Italy. "How do you think we feel about this?" one Saudi said to me during that long, tense prelude. "The whole world is free to comment on this, except for us, and we are the people who will be affected." I spent most of the war in my flat, watching the war on Al Jazeera and Fox, two rather similar news organizations. Each was wedded to a particular narrative. On Fox, the story was Operation Iraqi Freedom, the American liberation of the oppressed Iraqi people, told from the blinkered viewpoint of the embedded reporters. The implicit goal of the war was dancing in the streets, the visual that would go with the liberation motif. On Al Jazeera, it was the continuing humiliation of the Arabs. Iraqi Hiroshima was the logo behind the newscasters. There were countless shots of surrendering Iraqi troops, hands behind their heads, shuffling past the American conquerors. Charred corpses in the street, women in abayas being frisked by a female Marine. These were images of a subjugated nation, not a liberated one. One sequence, which I first saw on CNN, was a video of a pair of U.S. Marines knocking on the door of a house they intend to search. A military analyst, a very hip retired American general with a flat top and the sleeves of his sport coat rolled up, proudly demonstrates to the TV audience the proper way in which the soldiers evacuate the home. "Notice their stance on either side of the door," the general remarks, as the father is made to bring out his wife and children. "Notice the placement of the soldier's hands on the outside of the trigger guard," the general says, ignoring the face of a little girl whose lips are trembling and whose eyes are so wide with fright they look as if they could explode. "Notice the way the soldiers have taken control of the situation," the general says, as the family is made to kneel at the feet of the Americans. This scene was captured by Al Jazeera and repeated endlessly, obsessively, ritualistically, because it expressed so poignantly the theme of the war from the Arab perspective. My own paper, The Gazette, published a photo on the front page of an Iraqi child with his head blown off. The Arabic press and many of the satellite channels framed the bombing of Baghdad as America's war on children. The Saudi public was understandably inflamed. One Jeddah merchant waved a copy of Al-Watan in my face and pointed at a photograph of an Iraqi boy being treated for hideous burns. "You think he will grow up and think that America is a great nation?" the man demanded. He showed me another newspaper with a picture of two dead Iraqi soldiers in a foxhole, their heads missing, with a white flag of surrender beside them. Standing over the foxhole were two American soldiers. I'm not opposed to this kind of journalism. I hate war and think it should be seen for what it is. The dead and wounded Iraqi children should be a part of our conscience. The Gazette's editorial slant was clear from the beginning. Wounded U.S. soldiers in shock and awe, read a headline a week after the war began. Like every other paper in the kingdom, the Gazette gloated when the Iraqi troops made a stab at resistance. There was a front-page story about the imam of the Grand Mosque calling for an end to the unjust war. Muslims across the kingdom prayed for Baghdad's victory against the U.S.-British aggressors, the story read. One steamy evening, I went to a shisha bar with Dr. Khaled M. Batarfi, a columnist for Al-Madina. As a child, Khaled had been Osama bin Laden's friend and next-door neighbor. Khaled was constantly laboring for peace and was on a mission to help Saudis and Westerners understand each other. I had become quite fond of him. We began discussing what we thought would be the long-term effect of the war on Saudi Arabia. In Khaled's opinion, America's aggression showed that it was intending to remake the Middle East in its image. But what you really want is to divide the kingdom into several states so you can take our oil, and we will have no power to resist you, he said. Many Saudis believed that the invasion of Iraq was the opening act of a drama that would end with their main ally and protector consuming them. The whole world is undoubtedly seeing the American cowboys as having come for only one aim: killing, destruction, and bloodshed, Khaled's newspaper declared in an editorial that morning. The relentless theme of the Saudi media was that the sole objectives of American power were oil and murder. The next morning at the Gazette office, Ramesh came into the local reporter's room with a mischievous look on his face. "Well, we're all pro-American now," he said. "What do you mean?" He told me that all the editors-in-chief in the kingdom had been ordered to drop their anti-American line. At lunch that day, I asked Khaled Batarfi if Al-Madina was really going to change its editorials. He gave me a resigned nod. The editors were told no more pictures of dead babies. Also, don't call it an invasion. Indeed, by the next morning, the entire Saudi press had moderated its position on the war. It was a strange experience for me. With all my preaching about the need for a free press, the newspapers suddenly appeared more sober and responsible, and I felt a sullied sense of relief. In the days after the war, however, reports began to appear about young Saudis who had responded to the calls for jihad against the Anglo-American coalition. Volunteers achieve martyrdom, was how it was reported in the Gazette. One of my reporters, who had lost a friend in Iraq, invited me to meet some other young members of his tribe. They were Bedouins, and inside the middle-class apartment in South Jeddah, where his brother lived, there was a room that replicated a desert tent, the ceiling draped with fabric, and bolsters on the rug to lean against as we sipped tea. Inside the tent were four men in their 20s. The death of a friend was nothing new, they told me. They had already lost a number of young male relatives in Afghanistan, and another one in Iraq. I asked them how they thought Saudi Arabia would be different 10 years from now. The youngest of them, who had a wispy beard, said, "I think the Americans will invade Saudi Arabia, and a quarter of the population will be in American jails." Another told me that he prayed the Saudi government would evolve into a pure Islamic state, following the Taliban model. The oldest Bedouin was a delicate man with long, fine fingers and a pointed goatee that gave him a noble and stylized appearance. His round, wire-rimmed glasses caught whatever dim light there was inside the pavilion, making it hard to read his eyes. I was intrigued by him, perhaps because of his intellectualism and his romantic revolutionary air. The man who was killed was his cousin. I asked him what force had drawn his relative to Iraq. "It's when you have this power inside you, and in this closed country you can't get it out, that you go to such places," he told me. His cousin couldn't find a job, he continued, and he didn't have the connections to get into the military. He himself had experienced the same problems. "Since the first Gulf crisis, I graduated with a good major, and the government promised me a lot of things," he went on. "I have the ambition to have a PhD or a great job, and I suddenly found that the government put a new rule. They stopped any new government employment. The price of electricity and gas doubled, and the phone, and even rice and sugar. But they said, be patient. We have to pay the price of the war. They promised it was just for a short period. It's been 13 years now. I graduated 7 years ago and still have no job." He said he often thought about becoming a martyr himself, like his cousin, who must have gone directly to paradise. "Paradise is better than this miserable life." I asked what he had studied in school. "Library science." With all their talk about martyrdom, there was another dark thought in their minds. "It might be government policy to send these guys to Iraq instead of having them here, acting up," the oldest one said. "Who are you talking about?" I asked. "Who is sending them?" "Somebody who wants to make moral points around the world. They want to have these guys get killed instead of staying in the country and helping it out." The others nodded. They saw a conspiracy between the clergy and the government, a plot to eliminate them, the unemployed Saudis. "It's been a holocaust for young people, what's happened in Iraq and Afghanistan," the librarian said. These young men recognized the pointlessness of jihad, at least the way it was being promoted by the bloodthirsty clerics, who were, after all, government employees. There had to be a reason that the government would allow such dangerous talk, and in the minds of these young men, the reason was that they were expendable. And a part of them said yes to that. They wanted out, and the only exit was paradise. I met my reporters for the final time in the Gazette conference room. I had a deep sense of disappointment about how little I had accomplished. Many of the stories my reporters had labored over never got published. There were a few good pieces, such as a profile Najla had written of the American Consul General in Jeddah, Gina Abercrombie Winstanley. But Dr. Yusuf was angry that the piece had not been cleared with him. I handed out a few mementos, including Texas Longhorn keychains for the women, for the day when they finally could drive. There was a brief farewell party for me, with punch and pastries. Dr. Yusuf gave me a watch. The party was delayed a bit by my insistence that the women be allowed to attend. Najla handed me a card that everyone had signed. I said goodbye without once seeing her face. Hassan Hatrash wasn't there. I found him in the cafeteria, his shoulders hunched, drinking tea and picking at a half-eaten piece of chocolate cake. He looked shattered. "I just got out of the hospital," he told me. "The doctor told me I shouldn't drive, but I wanted to come here and see you." He said he had low blood pressure, but that wasn't the real problem. "I told the doctor, when I sleep, I can't wake up. I can't even put my thoughts together. He said that's depression. He seemed to me like many other young Saudis, whose lives are so unrealized and unexpressed. I wanted to give him some final word of advice, but I could think of nothing useful to say. On May 12th, a few weeks after I left the kingdom, Al-Qaeda bombed 3 Riyadh housing compounds, killing 34. A subsequent bombing in November killed 18. Throughout the fall and into winter, there were frequent raids and shootouts with suspected terrorists, and Saudi authorities claimed to have prevented several other catastrophic attacks, including at least one directed at the royal family. Reformers seized upon this volatile moment to campaign for certain progressive changes, such as an independent judiciary and popular elections. The government began a very difficult process of trying to bridle the radical voices in the mosques and cull certain hateful passages from the textbooks used in Saudi classrooms. The press was allowed to cover these events more freely than in the past. Then again, the coverage served the government's interest in quelling Western critics of the regime. When I read some of these more candid reports, my optimism about the Saudi press resurfaced. In March, Jamal Khashoggi was hired to be the editor-in-chief of Al-Watan, a sign perhaps that the government was going to allow the press more freedom. And indeed, Khashoggi published searching articles about the legacy of Wahhabism and cartoons ridiculing the religious police and the corrupt clergy who encouraged the suicide of Muslim youth. Those who committed yesterday's crime are not only the suicide terrorists, but also everyone who instigated or justified the attacks, everyone who called them mujahideen, even everyone who kept silent, Khashoggi wrote after the May bombings. But days later, Khashoggi was fired. Soon afterward, Hussein Shobokshi, the businessman who had been planning the class-action suit about Jeddah's sewage problem, wrote a column in Okaz in which he fantasized about a future Saudi Arabia. The story is powerful because it seems so ordinary, but so unreachable. He writes about returning from a business trip in Riyadh, where he has received a prize on behalf of the kingdom from an international human rights conference. His daughter, a lawyer, picks him up at the airport and drives him to the office. On the way, they talk about voting in the municipal elections the next morning. He tells her to hurry because he doesn't want to miss the broadcast of the finance minister proposing a national budget. After the article appeared in Okaz, the government ordered the paper to stop publishing Shobokshi's column. Soon after I returned home, Najla wrote me a note saying that she had been fired. She asked for my help in finding a job. Then I heard from Mamdu Alharthi, who said that he had quit the Gazette and wanted to go to journalism school in the West. And Hassan Hatrash wrote to say that he'd gone to Malaysia for a vacation. In Kuala Lumpur, he was invited to sit in with a band. I had the time of my life, and the number of chicks who wanted to talk to me was more than I could handle, he reported. The good news is, they invited me to play with them in their second gig at a bigger club on Sunday. Wow, finally I'm living.
The Terror Web. For much of Spain's modern history, the organization that has defined its experience with terror is ETA, which stands for Euskadi ta Askatasuna, Basque Homeland and Liberty. ETA, which was founded in 1959, has a clear political goal. It wants to set up a separate nation, comprising the Basque provinces in northern Spain and parts of southern France. Although ETA has killed some 800 people, it has developed a reputation for targeting almost exclusively politicians, security officials, and journalists. Over the years, the terrorists and the Spanish police have come to a rough understanding about the rules of engagement. They don't commit attacks on the working class, and they always call us before an explosion, telling us where the bomb is situated, an intelligence official in the Spanish National Police told me. If they place a bomb in a backpack on a train, there will be a cassette tape saying, "This bag is going to explode, please leave the train." And so, on March 11, 2004, when the first reports arrived of mass casualties resulting from explosions on commuter trains, Spanish intelligence officials assumed that ETA had made an appalling mistake. At 7:37 a.m., as a train was about to enter Madrid's Atocha station, three bombs blasted open the steel cars, sending body parts through the windows of nearby apartments. The station is in Madrid's center, a few blocks from the Prado Museum. Within seconds, four bombs exploded on another train, 550 yards from the station. The bombs killed nearly 100 people. Had the explosions occurred when the trains were inside the station, the fatalities might have tallied in the thousands. 250,000 people passed through Atocha every workday. The trains at that hour were filled with students and young office workers who live in public housing and in modest apartment complexes east of the city. Many were immigrants who had been drawn by the Spanish economic boom. As emergency crews rushed to the scene, two more bombs demolished a train at the El Pozo del Tío Raimundo station, 3 miles away. By then, José María Aznar, the prime minister, had learned of the attacks, which were taking place at the end of an uneventful political campaign. The conservative Popular Party, which Aznar headed, was leading the socialists by 4.5 points in the polls, despite the overwhelming opposition of the Spanish population to the country's participation in the war in Iraq, which Aznar had backed. It was Thursday morning. The election would take place on Sunday. At 7:42, 1 minute after the El Pozo bomb, a final bomb went off on a train at the suburban Santa Eugenia station. Emergency workers arrived to find mangled bodies littering the tracks. The Spanish had never seen anything like this. The worst ETA atrocity, in 1987, had killed 21 shoppers in a Barcelona grocery store. At Santa Eugenia, there were so many wounded that rescue crews ripped up the benches in the waiting area to use as stretchers. In all, there were 191 fatalities and 1,600 injuries. It was the most devastating act of terrorism in European history, except for the 1988 bombing of Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland. Aznar, who survived an ETA car bomb in 1995, had made the elimination of the group his top priority. His security forces had decimated ETA's ranks, but they were aware that remnants of the organization were attempting to stage a retaliatory attack in Madrid. The previous Christmas Eve, police had arrested two ETA commanders who had planted backpack bombs on trains. And in February, the Civil Guard intercepted an ETA van that was headed to the capital carrying 1,100 pounds of explosives. Authorities had planned a major strike against ETA for March 12th, the last official day of campaigning. Such a blow might have boosted Aznar's party at the polls. ETA, however, had seemingly struck first. At 10:50 a.m., police in Alcalá de Henares received a call from a witness who pointed them to a boxy white Renault van that had been left that morning at the train station. "At the beginning, we didn't pay too much attention to it," an investigator told me. "Then we saw that the license plate didn't correspond to the van." That clue, though, struck a false note. When ETA operatives steal a car, they match it with license plates from the same model car. It had been years since ETA had made such an elementary mistake. The lack of warning, the many casualties, the proletarian background of many of the victims, and ETA's quick disavowal of the crime all suggested that there was reason to question the assignment of blame. Moreover, the telephones of known ETA collaborators were bugged. The bad guys were calling each other, saying, "Was it us? It's craziness," a senior intelligence official said. That afternoon, detectives looked more carefully at the white van. They collected fingerprints, and under the passenger seat, they found a plastic bag with 7 detonators matching the type used in the bombings. There were cigarette butts, a woman's wig, and a Placido Domingo cassette. In the tape player was a different recording. It bore Arabic inscriptions and turned out to be Quranic recitations for religious novices. By that time, police had learned that the explosive used in the bombings was Goma 2, which ETA no longer used. "We told the government that there was something odd, that it was possibly not ETA," the intelligence official told me. That evening, however, Prime Minister Aznar called the editors of Spain's newspapers. "ETA is behind the attacks," he assured them. Then he called José Luis Rodríguez Zapatero, his socialist opponent, to tell him about the van with the Arabic tape. At the same time, he insisted that there is no doubt who did the attacks. The case broke open in the middle of the night, when a young police officer, sorting through belongings recovered from the trains, opened a sports bag and discovered 22 pounds of Goma 2, surrounded by nails and screws. 2 wires ran from a blue mobile phone to a detonator. It wasn't clear why the bomb had failed to explode. Police officers realized that a chip inside the phone would contain a record of recently dialed numbers. By tracing these calls, they were quickly able to map out a network of young Arab immigrants, many of whom were known to Spanish intelligence. Data stored on the chip revealed that a calling plan had been set up at a small telephone and copy shop in Lavapiés, a working-class neighborhood near the Atocha station. The store was owned by Jamal Zougam, a Moroccan who had previously been under surveillance because of alleged connections to Al-Qaeda. Information began leaking to the public about the direction of the investigation. By Friday afternoon, demonstrators were standing in front of the Atocha station, holding signs that linked the tragedy to the war in Iraq. It was clear that the election would swing on the question of whether Islamists or ETA terrorists were responsible for the bombings. That day, the Interior Minister, Ángel Acebes, insisted publicly that ETA was the prime suspect, even though the police were now certain that ETA was not directly involved. At twilight, some 11 million Spaniards assembled around the country to protest the violence. In rainy Madrid, the umbrellas stretched for miles down the Paseo del Prado. The anger and grief of the marchers were compounded by confusion about the investigation. "I walked with a million people in Madrid's streets," Diego López Garrido, a socialist deputy in the Spanish Congress, told me. "Many people were saying, 'Who is the author of these attacks?' And they wondered, 'Why is the government lying to us?'